Welcome to episode 19 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley. On today's episode, I'm joined by Mike Allen, who hosts a great podcast called Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. So welcome back, Mike.
Brent, it's always great to be with you.
So this is a discussion that I've been hoping to have for a long time because I'm closing in on my 20th episode, and it was you and this podcast that inspired me to start my own. So how did you start Amazing Tales?
So it's really a long story that I will try and keep very brief. I'm retired, so I'm in my 60s, so I can share that. And my first job, my first career, was actually in journalism. And I always had sort of a natural curiosity about how things worked and, understanding, things like the development of society and just all sorts of stuff like that. So journalism was a great field for me. And I got to work at the National Public Radio station in Boston, WBUR, back when I was in college. And I used to do hour-long radio documentaries for WBUR. And this was back in the day before the word digital even existed. There were no cell phones, there was no internet, and there was no digital recording as there is today, of course. So back then you had tape and actually reel-to-reel, and a lot of people, younger people in the audience won't know even what I'm talking about, but cassette recorders and that sort of thing. It was really quite a different time. And, we used to record interviews, and then when we did edits, we actually used a razor blade and tape, like a Scotch tape, but a modified Scotch tape to hold the tape together that we recorded on. If we had to take out some part of the interview, that's how we'd do it. And so you'd end up with a reel-to-reel tape with all sorts of little pieces of tape, along the way, and you just prayed that when it was playing back, the tape didn't undo, and there goes your entire show. So it was that kind of time. Anyway, from those days, I was able to do stories, in-depth stories, and interview people, and it was really great fun. Then I went into commercial radio and did that for 10 years, and then did two other things in my career, one in government, one in corporate. And then when I retired, my old radio station in Connecticut, I-95, based in Brookfield, called me and said, look, we know you got some time on your hands now. How would you like to come in and chat once a week about something local? And I said, well, I'll tell you what, can we do local history? Because I would find that fascinating. And they said, sure. So we started a program called The Place You Live, which I did on Tuesday mornings. I'd come in and spin a yarn about something that was in the greater Danbury, Western Connecticut area, Litchfield County, Fairfield County, New Haven County, talking about, if you drive by on Route 7 and look out your window as you're driving by at this location, here's what happened there back in blah, blah, blah. And it became very popular. People really liked it because I think we're all kind of the same this way. We may not have all liked history class going through school, but I think we all kind of like to associate where we live with something that happened that was kind of interesting or fun and say, gee, I didn't realize that happened there. Or in the case of Reading, where you're the co-town historian, that's where Mark Twain lived. Things like that. People go, wow, that's amazing. And so I was doing this at I-95 for about a year and a half, and I said, I think I don't know anything about this podcast business, but I think I could figure it out. It took me about half a year to figure it out, but I said, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna jump in with both legs and see what happens. And the first episode I put out, ironically, was on Mark Twain, and this is before you and I even met, Brent. So I was speaking with the outgoing head of the Mark Twain Library in Reading about Mark Twain, and I got 3 downloads. And I thought, my goodness, this isn't a lot, and what have I done?
Right.
It was kind of a disaster. And I talked to some knowledgeable people in the field, and they said, look, you got to be patient, you got to let it build, you got to do a little promotion, and it will happen. So now I'm up to almost 200,000 downloads in the last 2.5 years, and I've done about 135 weekly episodes. And so I've sort of found my groove, if you will, and it's going along very well, and that's how I got going.
That's crazy. That's a lot of downloads. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, it's a lot. You know, they build up, you know, and it's what ends up happening is that that same Mark Twain episode that I did 2.5 years ago, every month we'll get 40 new downloads from people who haven't heard it. You know, they'll hear my more recent stuff, and they'll say, well, gee, let's go back and see what else he's done. And they'll go back to episode number one, and there's Mark Twain, and they'll listen to that. And, you know, so every month you count up every single download for every single show, and I get about $10,000 to $15,000 downloads a month.
You wish the dollar amounts were there.
Yeah, there we go. Not quite.
So what are you, so obviously, as I know, like these are your babies. Like, so what episodes really are the ones that you're really the most proud of or had the most fun with?
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. You can't, you know, it's like, who's your favorite child? They're all different. They're all great in their own way. But I tend to sort of group them together. And the ones that I find personally fascinating is I try and remember what Connecticut was like. I gave a talk the other day, and, you know, I was saying to people, it's hard to realize this, but at one point, Connecticut was the frontier. You know, we always think about, you know, pushing west and the Northwest Passage and the Wild, Wild West. Now, Connecticut was the frontier 400 years ago. And I like to go back and think about that. You know, as you're driving along and you see a house being built, you know, the guys are cutting down trees and you got the John Deere or, you know, Caterpillar machines clearing the land. Well, before they started doing that, that was virgin green land. And Connecticut, that's all it was back when indigenous people were here. And so when you go back and try and imagine that and then see how did the state develop and, you know, why do we have I-95, I-84, and I-91 where they are? You know, those were the original U.S. post roads. And, you know, why do we have, you know, bridges? You know, the Connecticut River was a major problem for people because it was so wide, and how do you get across it in the first, you know, they didn't have bridges at first, they had ferry boats, and the oldest ferry boat in the country, that was one of my favorite episodes. It's only a little, you know, 5-minute putt-putt between Rocky Hill and South Glastonbury, but it's the oldest continuous ferry service in the country, dating back to the 1600s. And it's, you know, only takes 2 or 3 cars at a time across the Connecticut River, but it gives you an idea of what it's been like, you know, developing Connecticut. And then you look at the stagecoach era, which is one of my favorite times in Connecticut history, is 20 years where we got around by stagecoaches. And, you know, so you look at the original 100 dirt turnpikes, and I remember speaking to the guy who, during COVID, actually made this a COVID exercise, John Schwimmer, decided to just drive all 100 dirt turnpikes. You can find out where they were online, but he still had to do research because those roads don't still exist in their entirety.
Oh, yeah, no, the one that went through Sharon down to the Cornwall, you know, covered bridge.
Precisely.
I found that one too, but that took me through a swamp, and I had plenty of ticks on me when I got out.
That's exactly right, you know. And so you see, you know, this development trend, and then you get one of my favorites is Farmington Canal, right? So people look at me cross-eyed when I tell them that we used to have an Erie Canal type of project in Connecticut that split the state right in half between east and west and went right up from New Haven into Massachusetts. And, you know, just like a river, you couldn't get across it unless there was a bridge. And people shake their head. They can't believe that we had it like that for 20 years in the early 1800s. And today it's a bike, you know, trail, a bike hike path. But
yeah.
It used to be a canal that actually delivered goods from central Connecticut down to the New Haven Harbor and up into Massachusetts, and, you know, it's remarkable. And
then, well, that was a great episode because I didn't know the information that came out from it. Like, it was such a layered, informative kind of piece because I knew that there was two different locations that were, you know, vying for control of Connecticut, so to speak. But I didn't realize that that canal was, they were hoping to overtake the Erie Canal and bring them into, like, New Haven, right?
Yeah, they had plans to go all the way up into New Hampshire and Vermont. But this was in the days before something we now call the Interstate Commerce Commission. They didn't have that back then. And so the states were trying to figure out amongst themselves, well, how do we do these basically federal projects, you know, multi-state projects? And they had to go to the state legislatures, and they had to, you know, battle it out politically, and are we going to grant them rights to the locks along the, you know, the canals? It was just endless, and it took a lot longer to develop as a result. And then, of course, it got blown away because trains came along.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Sharon used to have a train line coming into it, and, you know, and now the Housatonic Railroad still, you know, chugs along barely. I mean, it's got two freight runs a day going up from essentially Newtown up into Massachusetts, but it used to go all the way from Bridgeport to Massachusetts with passenger line, and it's one of the original train lines from Connecticut from the 1800s.
Yeah, that was 1841, and yeah, we were actually, there was going to be a canal up here. There was locally, Ed Kirby, you know, did all of the local history that we really are aware of, and that was in one of his books, all the canals that were planned, and then unfortunately, Farmington was the only one. So
yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It got chartered. They had the charter to do it, but they never built it. You're right.
So what else?
Well, you know, when you look at, you know, again, if you go back to the original, you know, how was Connecticut developed theme, and, of course, it all started, you know, in this section of the country, New England, with the British landing in Massachusetts at Plymouth, you know, first, and then in the Boston area settling what's Cambridge today. And, you know, so you had the Plymouth Plantation and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, those two locations in Massachusetts, and eventually those people settled Connecticut. And, you know, to do the story of the Plymouth Plantation taking a boat and sailing around Cape Cod, going down past Rhode Island into Long Island Sound to Saybrook and up the Connecticut River and landing at Windsor, and that was the first town, you know, settled in Connecticut, and they brought along enough wood on that boat to build the first structure in Windsor, Connecticut. And then you hear the story of Thomas Hooker, who founded Hartford, and he came down from the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Cambridge with 100 people and 100 cows, and they walked the Old Connecticut Path. And this remains still one of my favorite episodes of all time, was the Old Connecticut Path, because you can still walk on this thing. It's basically a 400-year-old walking path from Cambridge, Massachusetts to Hartford. And a lot of it is still intact in northeast Connecticut that you can walk along. It's just phenomenal. And I was able to interview the guy from Massachusetts who pieced this whole thing together. And I'd love to get a project together to protect what's left of it and, you know, and draw attention to this, because it's really amazing. The old paths that, you know, essentially indigenous people used, and then when European settlers got here, they improved upon them. And it's fascinating. And it's basically where I-84 goes today, conceptually. It's that same sort of shortcut between Hartford and Boston that I-84 represents.
Yeah, that's like one of my favorite topics. I've given many, many talks about it, because we all use the old, you know, whatever you want to call it, Native Americans, Indians, indigenous peoples, pathways to get to the different areas. And obviously, settled on their plantations, but the fact that that one's still intact and you can walk on it is just a real gem of, you know, what was. Because, you know, like you, I imagine what it was like when Europeans got here, and I couldn't imagine, you know, Hooker coming down with all those people coming through the woods. You know, I live obviously in the woods, and not having a path to walk upon, because it's just not possible. But you know, that's the other one I liked that you did, was on the Appalachian Trail, because Appalachian Trail kind of ties into that same kind of theme. And you provided information in that episode that I wasn't aware of. I didn't realize that the source of it really starts in Connecticut.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, a Connecticut man started it, and although the first part of the trail technically was started in nearby New York State in Rockland County, Connecticut was not far behind, and it was a farmer from Sherman who there's a bridge named after him that goes over the, I think it's the 10-mile river, and it's just, it goes through what I consider to be some of the most gorgeous land in Connecticut in the northwest corner of the state. It's just, I would love to live in the northwest corner of the state. If my wife didn't have to commute to work, I probably would consider doing that. But it's just it's God's country, and this trail just takes you right through the heart of the beauty of it. So that's great, too. And then, you know, if you go back to eastern Connecticut for a second, the last Green Valley was another episode I loved because, you know, eastern Connecticut is still like it was when the settlers first got here because there's not been a lot of development. I think the statistic is 70 to 75% of the land remains in the same shape it was in back in the 1600s. And when you think about that, I mean, when I was doing the research for the Old Connecticut Path and driving around northeast Connecticut, I got to tell you, if I didn't have a GPS, you could get lost in there, and it's just as rural and as, you know, really just, it's like the frontier still, and you know, the locals know it, but you have some dirt roads in there that aren't necessarily regularly maintained, and it's, you know, it's challenging to get around.
Oh, no, my cousin lives in Brooklyn, and it's gorgeous out there, and then we had some friends that moved to Hebron, which is just on the other side of the border of Glastonbury, and it's like you're going back to like farm country. It's really neat on that side. And when we were partnering with, you know, state issues, we would always go to Council of Governments on the eastern side to, you know, to partner because we were both dealing with the same kind of issues, you know, on either side. So yeah, that was good. But you've touched on so many like topics that I wasn't aware of, like this. The one that really stood out to me that I wasn't aware of was your tale of the Whispering Giants.
Yeah, a lot of people.
That was a really nice pickup.
Well, and the reason why is because there is no Whispering Giant, and that's the hook is that, you know, here's an artist who I'm actually still in touch with, Peter Toth in Florida, went around the country. And because his father was driven off his land in Hungary by communists back in the day, he felt an affinity toward indigenous people who he felt were driven off their land here in the United States. And so he went around to all 50 states and carved out of wood a statue of the sort of composite of the indigenous people in that region and gave one to each of the 50 states. And some of the states got lucky and got more than one. And so when I found out about this on vacation in Maryland, I said, oh, I got to look up Connecticut's. And I couldn't find Connecticut's, and I had to dig. And finally, on the Internet, I found that it was somehow in storage in Groton, Connecticut. And I did more digging and found out it used to be on display in Groton. It, you know, befell some maintenance issues, had to be taken down because it was rotting, and it's been sitting in storage ever since. And now it turns out that the indigenous tribes that are still in existence in eastern Connecticut really don't want it to go back up. So it's going to stay in storage and live out its life in storage. I'm not sure if they're actually going to throw it away at some point or what's going to happen to it, but it will not go back on public display.
Wow. No, but it was captured in history, and that's really the important part.
Yeah, and the other thing, you know, when you talk about Groton, it just brings to mind, you know, the whole maritime part of the state. So, you know, if you don't live in southeastern Connecticut, it's not on your mind every day just how connected Connecticut is to the sea. And, you know, sure, we think of Long Island Sound, but when you get to western Connecticut, Long Island Sound is beautiful, but it's not really much of open water. And, I mean, you can see, for heaven's sake, you can see Long Island across the water. It's pretty narrow. But when you start getting out to Stonington and New London and places like that, we really are a bit of a seafaring state. And one of the talks I'm putting together now is going to be called, you know, Maritime Adventures from Connecticut. The first guy who ever spotted Antarctica was from Stonington. The Resolute desk in the president's office, in the Oval Office, was made out of timbers from a British boat that had become stuck in ice and abandoned in the Arctic Ocean. And a crew from New London sailing up there found it and towed it back to New London, fixed it up, sent it back to England. The Queen was so impressed that she said, thank you, decommissioned it, took it apart, and made this beautiful Resolute desk. And that was the boat's name, the Resolute. And it's in the Oval Office. And, you know, when you think about these first, and Connecticut was second to only Massachusetts when it comes to whaling. Yeah. You know, back when we used to actually use whale blubber to light the lamps in the cities. You know, Connecticut was second to Massachusetts. We had whaling expeditions all the time going out, you know, into the open sea. And we're, you know, in fact, Stonington.
You kind of brought that to my attention. So there, that whale blubber oil was like kerosene back in that time?
Sure. I mean, that was the precursor to, you know, to oil. And in fact, what helped kill the whaling industry was the discovery of oil in Pennsylvania. That did that. And, you know, if you go to Stonington Point, now Stonington is the furthest east town in Connecticut along the southern coast. It borders Rhode Island. And they have a place there called Stonington Point, which is just magical. I mean, you go down there and it's like Mystic Village. It's just a magical, you know, drive-through. You feel like you're on Cape Cod. Anyway, we go to Stonington Point, and you're facing south. If you look to the right, which would be looking westbound or westward, you're looking at Long Island Sound. If you look to your left, which would be looking east, you're looking at the Atlantic Ocean. So you're right where the Long Island Sound and Atlantic Ocean meet, right there in Stonington. And it just tells you kind of everything you need to know about the, you know, the maritime fortunes of Connecticut. And, you know, the lighthouses. I have a soft spot for lighthouses. I just think they're beautiful. And we have them all up and down the coast, and the history of them is amazing. And, you know, when you find out that the last manned lighthouse in the United States, just that person just retired and they stopped manning the lighthouse in Boston Harbor 2 months ago, you know, you start to realize that's the end of an era. I mean, the, you know, lighthouses played such an important role for hundreds of years, and now they're all mechanical. But just, you know, amazing story there, too.
No, it's so true, and it's just, that's going to be my next episode. It's going to be the changing world of employment and how technology has really played a cutting role into certain jobs and over the course of time. But I think so. I hope that people listening today are curious about your podcast because you touch on so many things about history, but then there's other things that you touch on too that, like, for instance, the episode on 20,000 Leagues Under Long Island Sound, the whole, it was a two-parter about the submarine that went down. And that was shocking to me. And I'm claustrophobic, so the whole second part was like torture. but that was a great one, and then the other one you did about the small plane where the pilot dies, and then the father with his family in the plane has to not only remove the pilot, dead pilot, and put him in the back, which has had to be horrific, but then learn how to fly a plane, basically.
Yeah,
and that was a great episode.
I mean, the good news for this poor gentleman was that he had at least taken two flying lessons, so he wasn't completely foreign to the idea of flying a plane. But he had only flown a very simple, single-prop plane with no landing gear. Here he was in a double prop with landing gear, much different flying experience. And the amazing thing is all this is happening around Fort Myers, Florida. And you say, well, what's the Connecticut connection? The guy at the air traffic control tower in Fort Myers used to work at the Danbury Airport control tower, and he knew a flight instructor in Danbury who used to teach people to fly the particular plane that this guy was in. So he called him on his cell phone, and they worked together to transmit instructions to this guy to help him fly the plane. And he, of course, he landed it safely. But it's a heartwarming story. Absolutely.
I love just the whole concept of the cooperation between the couple that was guiding him down.
Yeah,
that was just fantastic. And then the fact they didn't really know what really happened for, like, I think days after.
Yeah, which is, you think with modern communication, how did that happen? But, the guy who called him on his cell phone from Fort Myers, that guy's cell phone died immediately after the incident was over. Literally, the guy was standing on the tarmac looking at the family that was getting out of the plane. He went to make a call, and his phone had died. And not just the battery gone out, the phone died. It never made another call.
And that's what I love what you do. These are amazing tales, but they're not, like, they're all different. Like, it's like they're your babies, but they're all so complex and different. And that's why I listen every week. And I hope that listeners on this one, you know, find it and do the same. It's addictive. I'll put it on my playlist as I drive and just listen to one after the other. Just one, you know, plays and ends and starts. And for those that have not listened yet, the guitar entryway will stick in your head forever.
Which was done by my son, by the way, Christopher. He actually, he
it's
wrote...
It's in my head now.
Like, he wrote and played that music, which is...
that's a cool... That's
yeah,
a really
very cool.
Connection.
It's a family affair. But,
so he's Mike Allen. His podcast is Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. And I hope you enjoyed this one. He really has a special podcast, and Mike's so, you know, so happy you could share, you know, this information today, and hopefully you'll gather more people listening.
Brent, thank you so much, and good luck on your 20th. I'm looking forward to hearing that myself.
Awesome. Yep, thanks, Dom. Looking forward to it. All right, so as we noted in all episodes, there's an email account you can write to. It's stories@robinhoodradio.com. Tell us what you want to know more about, what you liked, and we'll circle back. So until next time, be well and always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest.
Old Stories, New Information with Brent Colley is produced at the studios of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.